Tony Shelton, how wonderful to have you here as our music teacher tonight. I hope I'm not giving you flashbacks by playing Hernando's Hideaway.
Oh, my life is flashing before my eyes. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. Is it true that you could sing that word for word age two?
I think I was 18 months old and I was thinking, I know a dark secluded place, a place where no one knows your face. It's Hernando's Hideaway, olé. And then I'd blow out a match. And that was my big finish.
For the press packs that were asking for it.
Exactly.
So how did it work? Like, you guys would rock up like Theatre Royalty at a railway station and...
It was because the show would go on tour between the cities and so the press would be waiting to interview the cast as they got off the train to promote the show. But word got out, apparently, that I could sing Hernando's Hideaway. So there was Jill Perryman and Tony Lamond and Dickie Taylor and all these people stepping off the train with big smiles and they'd go, where's the kid who blows out the match? And I'd be trotted out to sing the song.
Was that your first taste of performance, or do you have memories of watching your mum performing?
I used to watch mum on TV because she'd already started appearing on variety shows, and I had been carried on stage as a baby. But that's the first show that I can really remember, the Pajama Game. And I always tell cast members who have babies of their own and they bring them in, I say, your kids are going to remember this. So, you know, don't think it's all just going to be a blur of colour and lights. You're making memories at a very early age for these children.
Did you always know that you would go into show business?
I did. My parents actively discouraged me because they kept saying, look, you've seen us. There's no money. The hours are hard. There's a lot of insecurity. There's a lot of rejection. They kept pushing the negatives at me, and they really wanted me to get a good education and be a lawyer or a doctor. But I was steeped in it. My grandparents were in it. My aunt was in it. All our friends, my parents' friends were in it. So it was really my only frame of reference.
Well, let's start with this list of tracks that you've brought with you, the songs that you've loved. Let's kick off with a bit of the Beatles.
Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
When did this track come into your life?
Well, you have to remember that I grew up mostly around show records and female singers because mum was always on the lookout for new material. So the music in our house was the Judy Garland, the Peggy Lees, the Lena Horns, that sort of stuff, and Frank Sinatra, and cast albums of every show. Because Dad was also a dancer, and he was a producer of In Melbourne Tonight, so he was always on the lookout for material for people to sing. So pop music didn't really enter the equation. And when I did hear the Beatles at a very young age, it was Love Me Do, and it was Please Please Me. And compared to the theatre music that I knew that told stories and was richly orchestrated, that music was for babies. And then suddenly the Beatles started churning out stuff like this, Eleanor Rigby, where I sat up in my chair as a young boy and went, what is this? It was a story that I couldn't follow, so that made it mysterious. The violins and the orchestration of it and the beautiful harmonies, I suddenly, for the first time, woke up to the fact that pop music was an art.
Eleanor Rigby died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came.
And were you allowed to listen to that at home, or was it something you had to do in secret?
It was at school. That was hearing what my friends were playing. I was allowed to play anything but at home, but it was just I wasn't going to spend my money on an unknown quantity, so I was saving up for the show records. The show record thing became something of an obsession. I became an historian about musical theatre from a very early age. And there's an author named Ethan Morden who calls it demento. Demento must be served. That sort of almost pathological thing of needing to find the rare and the obscure so you can be a completist.
And are you still like that now?
It's tapered off a bit.
But, because of space? Or?
And age. And of course, moving to America, I had to get rid of my collections. And
no,
yeah.
What did you do with them?
I gave everything away. I had rooms full of theatre programs, and I was writing a book about the history of musical theatre until about 20 years ago, and I gave away 30 years of research to somebody else. It was a process of slimming my life down so I could move overseas and pretty much start again at the age of 50.
Was it a bit of a wrench?
It was a terrible wrench, but you know, you have to just say to yourself, it's only things, and these things live in your brain and in your heart, and you can always find them again. Of course, you know, the age of CDs now, a lot of stuff gets reissued, but in those days everything was on LPs, so there was even more of a it was more important to have those things, the original albums that you could file and read and learn. And John O'May, the singer, once recorded an album of songs, and he said, I'm only putting liner notes on the back of the album so Tony Sheldon will have something to read.
Tony Sheldon is here. He's your music teacher. Tonight we're going through the list of tracks that he loves. I'm just curious, if you had this vast collection and you were intent on writing a history of musical theatre, and that's kind of been your anchor for a few years by the time you get to 50... Was it a risk for you to go, you know what, I'm going to ditch the anchor, I'm going to ditch this, and I'm going to go for it in the States on stage?
What was interesting was that when I went to America, I carried all that knowledge in my head with me, and everybody I met, I knew their history. And I received an award called the Theatre World Award, which is a big deal for Outstanding Broadway Debut. And I got up and I said for my speech, I know everything about all of you. I said, I have studied you all. I've watched you, stage managers, become directors. I've watched dancers become choreographers. I've watched over the years. And I said, and I'm on the other side of the world, and you're just getting on with your lives thinking that the circumference of your career is New York. I said, you are changing lives all over the world by your example. You are inspired. Well, people started to get up and scream and applaud, and I got very emotional because it was true. It was suddenly like, oh, it's all been about this moment. And suddenly I was very much in demand to speak at theatrical things because people realised I was an historian, I was passionate about it, and I had all this knowledge. And I was this Australian kid that nobody knew. So I didn't need to have the records there. I carry them in my heart.
This is the next track on the list of songs that you love.
A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's the rest of a stump, it's a little alone. It's a sliver of glass, it is life, it's the sun, it is night, it is death, it's a trap, it's a gun. The oak when it blooms, a fox in the brush, the knot in the wood, the song of the thrush.
Now, I don't know that that's a Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66 songs that a lot of people will know.
No, it's by Jobim. It was interesting. My father died when I was 11, and my mother and I picked up sticks from Melbourne and moved to Sydney. Now, as I told you, all my musical influences were from my parents, and it was interesting watching my mother recreate herself as a single woman. She was in her 30s, and suddenly she changed in a lot of ways, and so there I was, watching those changes happen, and a lot of that was her tastes in music. And suddenly Sergio Mendes was being played around the house, and bossa nova, and so my tastes as a result started to branch out. And again, like Eleanor Rigby, the song The Waters of March is an enigma. It's a series of images that are seemingly unconnected, that every time, and there's many different translations of it, so sometimes you'll hear different people do it and the words change, so you keep trying to find the story, what is the thread. And then after many years, I read it was about a flood. It was about a river that breaks its banks.
Gee, it's upbeat for a song about a flood.
In Brazil, yeah, but it's the images of things getting swept away. And because there's a lot of rather gruesome images in there. There's the sound of a shot in the dead of the night, the body in bed. There's strange, unexplained images in it. And so if you think maybe it is things being collected by a flood, or it is about destruction and renewal, like Eleanor Rigby, it's a song that's open to interpretation endlessly, and that fascinates me.
A snake, a stick, it is
John, it is Joe. It's a thorn in your hand and a cut in your toe.
And it sounds like thematically it was probably what was going on in your own life.
Yes.
After your father committed suicide.
He did indeed.
And he was only, what, 39?
Yep.
It must have been earth-shattering for you and for your mother.
It was. It took many, many years for us to deal with. I don't know that we've entirely finished dealing with it. I think for me, particularly because I was left in the dark a lot about what led up to it. And so it sort of came out of left field for me. And then there was a lot of having to cover stuff up because we were public figures. And so Mum initially didn't want it to be known that it was a suicide because of the stigma of that. So, you know, we had to lie and say it was a heart attack. Then there was a very public inquest, and the Truth newspaper, which was a tabloid, decided to expose and investigate. And so it was like, it just dragged on, and it was horrible. And that was the major reason we moved to Sydney, was to get away from it. And also because the club scene up here was opening up, the RSLs, the Leagues Club, and Mum could get work doing a nightclub act. But it was interesting. Mum and I were sort of thrown together because she'd always been working. She'd always been at Channel 9, and I got shoved into boarding schools at an early age. And suddenly we had to get to know each other. And that was a difficult process. An 11-year-old boy with a rather volatile, glamorous mother having to find some sort of common ground.
And also with a mother grieving for the loss
of her husband. Absolutely, you know.
And all that public exposure in the Truth newspaper. It was a 3-part article.
It was what killed Frank Sheldon. It was horrible. They published a picture of my mother in a leotard dancing and said, you know, the grieving widow. It was truly horrible.
Would have been tough for you at school then.
It was, and school was tough anyway because I really had nothing in common with my peers at all. I lived in this showbiz bubble surrounded by adults, witty, funny, clever adults, and suddenly I was in a very sports-oriented, cadets, outward bound, tough school that had no time for the likes of me. And so I was very isolated, and things like music saved me. I had a little portable record player, and I used to haunt Lawson's and Ashwood's, the secondhand record shops, and find these rare records. And I would, every day at the end of the school day, I would hide because the other kids were out to bash me up all the time. I was bullied the entire time. And I would sit for that 2.5-hour period between the end of lessons and dinner and just lose myself in this music. And it sort of saved me.
Would you find yourself suddenly the hero at school, though, if you were starring in stage productions and
wasn't
concerts?
A hero, but I was lucky that I did discover school plays, and I didn't know I could act until that happened. And the good thing about my school was we did Tom Stoppard and Harold Pinter and really interesting stuff. And suddenly I went, oh, this is something I can do and I'm good at. And suddenly, yeah, people, they smiled at me in the corridor rather than punching me.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
It's amazing how bullies can turn around with a bit of showbiz pizzazz.
Yes.
Or amplify their efforts, depending. But you must have shut them up with whatever you did in the Pinter plays.
Yes, exactly.
Tony Sheldon is here. He's your music teacher tonight. We're going through the tracks that he loves. This is the next. This is Save the Country, Laura Naira. Makes you want to dance.
Absolutely.
It's great.
And that voice. And, you know, she writes all the songs. When I was 14, my Aunt Helen Reddy had moved to America. And I wasn't terribly close to Helen because, again, you know, I was in boarding school and she was making a career for herself.
And she was a single mother, wasn't she, at one point,
yeah,
trying to make ends meet?
When she won the bandstand contest.
And went
to New York, she was there with her little baby daughter. And she arrived thinking she had a contract with whatever the prize was that she'd won. And they said, oh, we were expecting a boy group. There's no market for female singers. Be sure to see the Empire State Building before you leave, dear. And there she was with no money and a kid on her hip, and she went, this is silly, I'm going to stay and do this by myself. And she did.
She certainly did.
Sheer bloody mindedness, she did. So when she'd had her first hit, which was I Don't Know How to Love Him, she'd moved to Hollywood and was living in a modest little house in the Hollywood Hills with her new husband, he who shall not be named, because she doesn't name him in her own autobiography. And
Voldemort.
She calls him number two because he was her second husband. She suddenly rang Mum and said, I want Tony to come over as a Christmas present. He can come over and spend Christmas with us 4 weeks. So suddenly I was whisked to Hollywood. I'll never forget. I walked in the door and it was the first time I'd ever seen colour television. But there, on the record stand, was this stack of albums. And now this was 1970. And there was Elton John's first album. There was Don McLean's first album. There was Richie Havens. There was Leon Russell. There was the concept album of Jesus Christ Superstar. These had all just come out. And this girl called Laura Nero. Well, Helen said, stop listening to those shows. Give a listen to this. And suddenly my entire love of music took a severe left turn. And it's just interesting to me that song, Save the Country, has suddenly come into a bit of a vogue at the moment in America. People are singing it at, like, Democrat conventions, and it's suddenly become terribly relevant all over again. We can build a dream with love and love.
You were saying when you came into the studio that you'd just seen Rocket Man.
Yes.
And you got emotional watching it because you were in some of the locations.
I was. I mean, I know that there are people who, you know, this was a major part of their life, but I actually was there living through that period with, you know, and Helen reminds me that she took me to Capitol Records and I selected the cover photo for her first album. She was showing me the proofs and she went, which one do you like? And I went, that one. She went, all right, well, that's the one it is. And she still says, you know, you do know you picked that photo. So it was a thrilling 4 weeks that made an enormous impact on a young man.
Doesn't she also hold you responsible for helping give her first hit because you were ringing radio stations requesting it?
Yes, that was because, I mean, it was like the Beatles actually used to go into the shops and bulk buy the albums. That was how they got their songs on the hit parade. So Helen and her husband and I, we all sat on the bed one day and we all took turns. We had the numbers of all the radio stations around America and we rang them all and requested I Don't Know How to Love Him. And then when we'd done it, we rang them again with different voices and we spent an entire day just being different people ringing all these numbers and we got that number onto the charts.
And the rest is history.
It is.
Should I bring him down? Should I scream and shout? Should I speak of love? Let my feelings out. I never thought I'd come to this. What's it all about?
Tony Sheldon is here. He's your music teacher tonight. This is the next track on the list of songs that he loves. Now, this is from Company. Why is this on the list of tracks that you love?
Well, of course, young people today won't realise that in the old days when records came out, they weren't always released through Australian companies. So often you had to wait for them to be imported or a kind person would send them from overseas. And one day I came home from school in 1970 and there was a package of three albums. There was Lauren Bacall in Applause. There was Katharine Hepburn in Coco and this musical called Company, written by Stephen Sondheim, starring Dean Jones and Elaine Stritch. And I'd read the review in Time magazine that called it a landmark. And I thought, ooh. And it said it has no story. It's about New York. It's about married couples in New York. And so, and it had a wonderful cover, which was purple and the writing of Company was in a sort of a hot pink. So I was intrigued. I thought, well, what's this? And then suddenly to hear that sort of like electric piano and that contrapuntal singing, that Bobby Bobby, it was a brave new step for Stephen Sondheim that suddenly put him on the map. It was like I could hear the genius in that music. And I don't think I put my school bag down. I put the record, the needle on the record, and I think I stood on the spot for like the entire first side of the album going, what am I hearing? It was like a thunderbolt, and I became obsessed about the show and every cast replacement and every new production. And then in 1985, the Sydney Theatre Company scheduled it for their season, and I wrote to the director and the musical director and said, I have to be in this in some small way. And I went in an audition and I got in. And so I actually got to perform in my dream show. And
15 years after you'd first heard the album.
15 years after I heard it. And it was still to this day is one of the happiest experiences I've ever had in the theatre. And the night it closed, I cried for 12 hours. Oh.
What makes it so special? Is it because of that brain explosion as a 15-year-old where you were listening, you just couldn't put your school bag down, or is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's something. It's one of those shows that just intrigues people, and because it is plotless, it's a series of vignettes, and it hits home. It's about relationships, and it's about whether people should be alone or whether they should wait for perfection, or is being coupled the natural order of things. It raises a lot of questions.
Do you wonder if, as a 15-year-old, if that's perhaps why it resonated with you, because you were alone, you were in boarding school, your mother was alone, she was dealing with addiction.
It might have on a subliminal level, but it also crackled with sophistication, which was what I was missing. It was what I'd been taken away from my early days. And so this humdrum, you know, blokey existence that I was being forced into, suddenly there was Elaine Stritch singing, here's to the ladies who lunch, you know. It was like, you know, oh, yes, this is where I want to be. But again, about what the appeal of the show is, it's a show that people have always felt there was something missing, and then it's just been reconceived in London with a girl instead of a boy as Bobby. And suddenly the show makes a hell of a lot more sense to a lot of people. The whole thing of pushing a 35-year-old into a relationship, the whole thing about it being a guy, it was sort of like, yeah, who cares? Suddenly if it's a woman, women feel a lot of pressure from their friends about, you know, don't you think you should be thinking about children?
And biological clocks.
The biological, yeah. And suddenly it's opened up the show in a very interesting way, and it's become a hit all over again. So I've been able to go out and buy the album again and hear it again with different people singing it. And, you know, it's going from London, it's going to go to Broadway, and it's got Patti LuPone in it, and life is perfect.
Do you get to ring them again and say, I'd really like to be in the reinvented
yeah,
version
yeah,
of Company?
Yeah, exactly.
No strings, good times, just chumps, Company. Late nights, quick pipes, party games, deep talks, long walks, telephone calls.
Tony Shelton is here. We're going through the list of tracks that he loves. I don't even ever heard this song before. Okay, I have heard that song before, but I think I've heard it like this.
You are the promised kiss of springtime that makes the lonely winter seem long.
So that's All the Things You Are, obviously sung in multiple different ways since its first incarnation in 1939.
Countless versions. It's probably one of the most recorded songs ever.
And he's been going, oh, I haven't heard this before. Oh, yes, you have. Just not the 1939 version.
Exactly.
So well, why is this on your list of songs?
Well, I met my my life partner back in 1979 when I was doing a show called The Venetian Twins. An actor named Tony Taylor was brought up from Melbourne to appear in the show. And here we are still together 40 years later, which is wonderful. But his favourite song is All the Things You Are, which was fine by me because I've always loved it. But over 40 years, I have listened now to every possible permutation and incarnation of that song. And it's weird how, speaking of the relationship thing with company, when people now ask me what my favourite song is, I tend to automatically say All the Things You Are. And I think it's not my favourite song, but because it's Tony's, it sort of has become my favourite song because he's my favourite thing in the world. So by default, it is my favourite song.
That's such a beautiful thing to say after 40 years together.
Well, it's been a wonderful 40 years and hopefully it'll continue.
Was it love at first sight?
For me it was, not for him. I actually like went boy, oi, 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 oi. I didn't know that happened. But he was getting over a relationship. And the three girls in our show, Valerie Bader, Addie Byron and Jennifer McGregor, worked together to get – they kept finding ways to throw us together. And after about 3 months, he suddenly turned around and looked at me for the first time. After we'd been working together really closely for 3 months, suddenly the penny dropped. So, yeah, after that it was plain sailing.
And so did he stay in Sydney or did you have some time apart? It sounds like he wasn't a Sydney
local. He moved to Sydney, yeah.
For you?
Yeah.
Has it been tough keeping it together because, you know, in theatre circles, and in showbiz circles, we see so many relationships falter.
Yeah, the first 10 years were the hardest. The first 10 years were really, really difficult. And then after that, I always think because people, I don't believe people grow simultaneously. I think people grow separately and then the other person has to catch up. And there are moments when somebody's needs help and somebody, you know, it's a constant negotiation and a constant changing. And it once you've got that down and realize that's how it works, it gets a lot easier. But now we're so in sync. And the thing is, we just never stop laughing. We make each other laugh all the time. And we love all the same things now. And but it took a long time to balance it.
Were you tough to live with? Because you've been very open about having bouts of depression, about self-medicating with alcohol and marijuana and whatever else you get your hands on.
Yeah. I mean, he still calls me a rat bag, you know, and I still am tough to live with, I think. Not that I'm moody or anything. I try not to inflict that on anybody. But when I'm alone, I buckle real fast and that's what's made it very hard about living overseas because Tony didn't come with me. Tony said, I can't start my career all over again in a new country. So he comes over as a tourist every 6 months or so. But I really find it hard not having him around all the time. Mm. And that's when my brain gets very dark. And I'm amazed that he has stuck it out all this time with me.
Your friends used to call you the walking time bomb.
Oh,
didn't they?
Yeah.
But then you gave up. It sounds like you gave up alcohol, cold turkey, cigarettes, cold turkey, marijuana, cold turkey.
Yes, food, cold turkey.
Geez, what are you eating? Nothing.
I don't eat sugar. I don't eat dairy. I don't eat gluten. You know, it's like I've had to work out what keeps my whole system in balance, and because a lot of the depression thing was that I have a tendency to obesity, and so always feeling unattractive and, you know, I'm ugly and, you know, reviewers used to write, you know, Tony Sheldon's looking, you know, extremely chunky, you know, and so that constant hacking away at your self-esteem, I still is such a problem. But I'm surprised more people aren't open about this because it seems so many people suffer from these demons, and you just think, God, everybody's walking around with so much baggage. Yeah, so.
Well, I mean, you look at your early life, I think a lot of people would understand why you're walking around with that sort of baggage. You know, your dad commits suicide when you're 11, your mum and you are living on your bones.
Yeah, but I tend to think you can't use that as an excuse. My mother excuses other people for that, you know, for bad behaviour from people. She goes, oh, well, she had a rough life when she was 10. And I go, yeah, but now she's 70 and we can't keep saying she treats people badly because she had a rough life when she was 10. I think you have to evolve and you've got to learn. That's what it's all about, surely. Isn't that why we're here? It's hard to get over core issues about how you see yourself. Mm. I think self-love is very, very hard. I think that's really probably the top of the hard list.
Was there an epiphany for you when you decided that you were going to give up all the self-medicating?
It was a comment by Paul Mercurio, the dancer, who gave an interview talking about his depression, and he said the sentence, "One day I just gave myself permission to be happy." And I thought, yeah, that I know it sounds simplistic, but there was my brain really was on, this is what it's going to be like all my life, and I might as well just keep drinking until I die. You know, so I was actively working to kill myself. And also, you know, because people around me, that was what they did. You know, if life got too hard, you killed yourself.
Well, your mum tried as well, didn't she?
11 times. And you sort of just cease to be sympathetic to it. And you've hardened yourself to such a degree because it's like, oh, well, ho-hum, she did it again, that you start to think about suicide in that way. And, oh, well, that's what you do. And so, I got to the point where I was doing that. And it was crazy. It was a crazy time.
How long ago did that stop?
Well, not that long ago. I got sick with pancreatitis. And the pain was so immense. Now, that was not 2002, so 17 years ago. And the doctors showed me an ultrasound of my pancreas and they said, see all those little spots? They're sort of little fatty deposits. It might help if you stop drinking because that probably will be the end of you. So I thought, well, I just don't want that pain anymore, that physical pain. That was so horrible. So I stopped. And to my utter astonishment, it was like, oh, okay. There was no cravings. There was no pining for it. It was like I just stopped. And it was a little bit harder to stop the cigarettes. And then a couple of years later, I stopped smoking the drugs. And then I wasn't losing the weight. So somebody said, well, have you thought about this diet? And like within 2 years, suddenly everything was in control.
Well, can I just say at 63, because you're facing me in the studio, I wish you could see Tony's skin because you look at his face and go, I want the moisturiser that you're using. It's fabulous. You look great.
Thank you.
Tony Sheldon is here. He's taking you through the list of songs that he loves. Now the tracks that he's not so keen on.
Oh, baby, I love.
Okay, what's going on with these guys? Why don't you want to hear this again?
The loved ones, red dress on, long black hair. Of course, when I was thrust out into the world of school and suddenly there were all these, my contemporaries were listening to radios, I had to listen to stuff like this. And I used to run screaming from a room when that track would come on, The Loved Ones. And when we moved to Sydney, my mother said, oh, I've got tickets for a concert at the stadium. She said, it's an English group called Dave D, Dozy Beaky, Mick and Titch. And I said, I've never heard of them. She said, it would be fun to go and see a pop concert. And who was the opening act? The Loved Ones. Red dress on, long black hair. And I turned to my mother and went, you planned this.
And did she?
No, she had no idea.
Did you run from the stadium?
She wouldn't let me. She said, no, we're here as honoured guests. You have to stay and watch Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Tit.
Did you do a good job of pretending that you were loving every minute
of
it? No,
I think I probably sat with my fingers in my ears.
Excellent. And now how about this one?
I've been crying over you, crying.
Poor old Roy. What's going on with Roy?
It's not this song, but it's his voice always. I just never warmed to his voice. And again, my mother plays an important part in this story. When she was in Sydney, she got hired to be the supporting act at the Chevron to Tiny Tim. And she put together a wonderful, glamorous act with two boy dancers. And Tiny Tim was lovely and it was all wonderful. And she was such a success. She said, I've been invited back. I said, oh, who are you supporting this time? She said, Roy Orbison. So I had to go and sit through his act every night for 2 weeks.
You know, every other kid would be going, wow, my mum's supporting Roy Orbison.
I know. And there was me sitting with my arms folded going, you know, why couldn't it have been some wonderful musical theatre person?
So is it fair to say that you're a bit of a musical snob?
Oh, absolutely I'm a musical snob.
Well, you were. Are you still?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay. No pop music in your life now?
Oh, no, there's pop music, but it's like Eleanor Rigby and The Waters of March. If it's got an interesting theme, if it's makes you think about something, if the orchestration is fascinating, then I'm there. But the more sort of simplistic stuff, I don't go for.
So no Kesha or Rihanna?
No. Dance music is not my thing.
Okay. Now, this is interesting because this is on the list of songs that you're not so keen on, and this is musical theatre.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by. When hope was high and life worth living.
Okay. Is this Les Mis?
It's Les Mis, which I've always felt was like the class. Do you remember classic comics where they were a comic book and they would do sort of like a comic book version of a classic book?
Yes.
So you could get The Count of Monte Cristo. And
I remember the Count of Monte Cristo one. That's the one I remember.
The Woman in White and The Mill on the Floss. And I always felt that Les Mis is the classic comic musical of Les Miserables. I just don't get it. And the problem was that all my friends kept getting into subsequent productions. And so you'd have to sort of go and support, you know, David Campbell or Peter Tapano or somebody who was going into a production. And I would sit on the edge of my seat and say, all right, you know, do it for me. And then after about 15 or 20 minutes, I'd sink back in despair and go, no, I just don't get it. Anyway, when I moved to America, my landlords are Audra McDonald, the wonderful Audra McDonald, and her husband, Will Swenson, who was in Priscilla with me on Broadway. And I love them and they're my dearest friends. And they said to me last year, well, 2 years ago, will you spend Christmas with us at our house up in Hudson? And I said, I'd love to. And they said, well, we'll drive you up. I said, oh, that would be lovely. They said, but Will's doing a performance of Les Miserables, so you come and see the show and then you can both drive up. And, of course, I had used every excuse in my book not to go and see Will in Les Miserables, but he was playing Javert and I had to sit through the show on Christmas Eve. And everybody around me was sitting there filming it on their phones, and they'd already bought the video of it at the merchandise stand. And I thought, I'm a lone voice in the wilderness here.
Now, are you allowed to confess that to Will? Or
I did. I said, I only for you would I do this.
And are you allowed to do that in theatre circles? Or is it a risky thing?
It's a very risky thing. Stephen Sondheim says that if you see a show, you are under an obligation just to say, I loved it and nothing else. He said, don't give notes. Don't say any reservations. He said, that's not part of the deal. He said, people don't want to hear what you really think. You just have to say, I loved it. Most people don't do that. Most people say, you know, but...
Have you ever had anybody say that to you?
What? Oh, yes. Oh,
I mean, you're okay in Priscilla, but...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, many times.
Really?
Yes. I remember doing a production of The Comedy of Errors at Nimrod, and I walked out to the foyer and a friend of mine just stood shaking his head like the prophet of doom, and that was all he had to do. He just didn't say a word, just shook his head balefully as though, no, there was no hope for anything in that production.
And what happens inside you when somebody does that?
Oh, a part of you dies.
Yeah. Because there's a little balloon just going...
Yes, absolutely.
What was it like for you being on stage in Priscilla? Bette Midler was producing... It must have been an extraordinary experience for you.
It was. I mean, I'm so glad that it came after a year in Australia and then a return season in Australia and New Zealand and then a year in London.
But so often you don't get to do that as an Australian star in an Australian production. They usually put somebody else, someone else in over the top of you.
I was the first one because, I mean, Boy from Oz went over, but they kicked out poor Todd.
Yeah.
So I was the first one who'd created a role in an Australian musical who got to go and play it on Broadway. I made history in my own tiny way. So it was a great thrill. But there was a part of me by then that I thought, I know this show, it is in my bones. Simon Phillips, the director, had given me free rein to write lines if I felt, you know.
That's amazing.
It was, the entire experience was so blessed, and that was why Tony, my partner, always said, you know, the universe was preparing you for this by making you give up all your crutches and making you stand on your own two feet. He said, otherwise I don't think you would have been ready. And it was wonderful because I had forgotten that the dream had been to get to New York because my career happened and I was happy just doing what I was doing out here. I was getting good parts and I'd sort of just given up there was ever any chance of performing over there. So I needed to be reminded by doing things like the Today Show on television where you'd be standing in Rockefeller Center as the sun came up, you know, singing We Belong and watching the sunrise over the New York skyline and going, oh, this is an out-of-body experience I'm having. So it was those moments, you know, looking out and seeing Shirley MacLaine sitting in the second row and mouthing at me, you're fantastic, and
wow,
and asking to come back and meet me. Oh. And the Broadway community embraces you in a way that no other community does anywhere else in the world. They take you to their bosom and they say, you are one of us.
How different is the theatre scene in the US?
Well, in New York, it's such a part of the tourist industry. Billions and billions of dollars are generated by theatre. So there it's considered as important as football is out here, you know. Mm. And there are so many more theatres all around. Minneapolis has 70 theatres in the 70 in the you know that Minneapolis area. That's my jaw dropped. So you don't realise what's going on all around the country.
And are American audiences much different to Australian audiences?
No, they're exactly the same. I find audiences all around the world are exactly the same.
They all cheer and clap.
They do, or sit in silence.
Musical theatre superstar Tony Sheldon's here. He's your music teacher tonight, son of Tony Lamond, nephew of Helen Reddy, and starring in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory at the moment as Grandpa Joe. We're moving on to his guilty pleasures now. Now, I'm surprised that this is a guilty pleasure, but anyway.
Don't let the day get the better of you. When the evening comes, there's so much to do. You better put on your best and wear a smile. Just come along with me a while, 'cause I tell you,
I thought you'd be out and proud with Petula Clark. It's a fabulous song.
It's fabulous. It's one of those songs that I find that I will be singing at the top of my voice when I'm walking down the street and I won't even know I'm doing it. But all those Tony Hatch and Jackie Trent songs that they wrote for Petula Clark are the same. You know, Don't Sleep in the Subway and Downtown, and they're just Colour My World. They're so jolly.
So you can colour my world with sunshine, yeah.
And it always fascinated me that Petula Clark was a child star and in movies and was this pretty little actress in movies. And then when the 60s rolled around, she found a different way of singing. She sort of, my mother used to explain it to me, she flattened her voice out almost so that her vibrato disappeared. And she recreated herself as a different entity and became the Petula Clark that we all know and love. So that fascinated me as well. I love the idea of recreation.
Now, how about this track?
The man that won you has run off and undone you. That great beginning has seen a final inning.
Judy Garland.
I never got Judy Garland when I was a kid. The house was stacked with Garland records because she was my mother's favourite singer. And for some reason, I didn't have the Judy Garland thing. I just went, no, I don't. She's not a proper singer. I just didn't get it. And it wasn't until I was probably in my 20s that suddenly I locked into the skill, the technical skill.
Why didn't you think she was a proper singer? Because she's such a belter?
Yes, and it always sounded like there was no control. And I very much liked people like Nancy Wilson and Mel Torme, who were, I suppose it's the Virgo in me, who were technically absolutely bang on. And I think the emotion in Garland's voice frightened me. Mm. But then as I became more of an emotional being, suddenly I went, yeah, I see it. And I've always thought that A Star Is Born is one of the great unsung performances in cinema history, and she really should have gotten the Oscar for it. She lost to Grace Kelly for High Noon. But The Man That Got Away, that's a sing in the shower song when you really want to warm up before a show. There's a lot in there to get your teeth into.
What do you do to warm up for a show?
The Man That Got Away.
In the shower.
In the shower.
Looking for the man that got away.
Okay, how about this one?
If you don't mind having to go without things, it's a fine life.
Fine life.
Though it ain't all jolly old pleasure outings, it's a fine life.
Fine life.
When you got someone to love, you forget your cares and strife. Let the prudes look down on us. Let the wide world frown on us. It's a fine, fine life.
Georgia Brown in Oliver. It's a fine life. Why is this?
What a voice. What a voice.
Great voice.
I was in Oliver when I was 10, and my mother played Nancy, and that's Nancy's first entrance into the show, is that song. And the show's all been very dark up to that point. It's all sort of browns and greys, and suddenly in this bright red dress, this vivacious woman bursts on stage singing that song. And so I got to sit there as one of those kids and watch my mother looking like an angel every night doing that song. And that particular recording of Georgia Brown, I just feel that voice cuts through glass. It's beautiful. And when I was in New York, I was asked to put together some material for like a cabaret act. And so I chose that song, and I interspersed each verse telling my experience of being in that show and my beginnings in show business, and turned it into like a comedy routine around that song, It's a Fine Life. It turned it into a 10-minute piece of material, and it was a great success for me over there. It was a wonderful introduction for me to cabaret audiences.
And we take good care of it, that we get our share of it, and we don't
need pets.
If you were in Oliver when you were little, does that mean that you get to 50 and you're on stage in Broadway having that pinch yourself moment going, oh my God, I'm actually here, that you don't get nervous because you've been on stage for so long, or are there still nerves?
Oh, there's still nerves. As Nancy Hayes says, there's more to lose each time because more people know your work and they expect to see you at the top of your game all the time. And people are more familiar with you, and so you're not a surprise anymore. So you've got to up the ante each time. And people, you know, doing press after for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I encountered people saying, oh, well, can you play a part like Grandpa Joe? And I thought, well, why would you ask me that? And it was because people thought all I could do was Priscilla. And you think, well, I had an entire career from the time I was 7 years old before I did Priscilla, that I played a lot of character roles, you know, but suddenly you think, I've got to keep proving myself that I can do this role, because there's always somebody who thinks you can't.
And is that where sometimes having that defining role, that career defining role, albeit, you know, 50 years into what's essentially been a showbiz career, can be a bit of a burden?
It can. I mean, it's wonderful in that it puts you on the map, but then you realise why people like Carol Channing and Yul Brynner stuck with it. And they kept going back to it because it's just easier. it's people remember you for it and they love you. And so it's like, you know, I don't have to keep trying some new show that's going to flop. A lot of those big stars had flops. Gwen Verdon, you know, Sweet Charity and all that. And she did a play and it ran one night. So often it's safer to stay where you are. I've always loved the whole idea of transforming myself from show to show. That's part of the joy, is not just being like a personality actor, but trying to be a character actor. I've always considered myself a character actor since I was a kid. And but it was when I was asked to come back and do Priscilla for the 10th anniversary, I jumped at it because I thought, yeah, I wanted to prove to myself I could still do it, that I could still pull it off, that I could still look good, that I could still dance, because I thought that opportunity is never going to come around again now that I'm 63. So it was a way of saying goodbye to that part of my career, and because probably it's going to be full of Grandpa Joe's now for the rest of my life.
Well, I was going to say, what is next? What's
well,
next?
Grandpa Joe, hopefully, for quite a while. But then I have to go back to New York because I have a green card, and I've missed out on a couple of things being back here. People are starting to write things for me now, and
that's amazing.
That is amazing. I had a play, Cleopatra, written for me by a very famous sort of off-Broadway icon named Charles Bush, and he wrote three roles for me: Julius Caesar's wife, and Lepidus, who was sort of the villain. And he structured those three roles around me, and then he wrote another play for me, and he called the character to Blackie because I have white hair, and I couldn't do it because I was out here, and the play actually had to go ahead without me. And there was a musical that was written for me that I couldn't do. So there are things that there's unfinished business in New York. I have to go back and see if I can pick up the pieces.
Well, we look forward to watching you as your career soars from strength to strength and going and finishing the business, Tony Sheldon. Thank you so much for being our music teacher
tonight.
Thank
you for having me, Chris. What a pleasure.
Lovely to meet you.